Mr. Cameron, Reel 8, we're talking about your time outside Port Suez. Now, we've mentioned the arrival of the black South African gunners, and you trained them. That also, of course, meant you lost half of your comrades, your old comrades. How did that affect you? I mean, did you lose any particular friends?
Yes. John Grange, my second in command, as I told you, we got on very well. He was a good worker and such. Now that was where we parted from him. I've only seen him once in those years since. But it was not only them, it was half the two then were posted away. So we were left with those equivalent of blacks. But that's the only way it affected the troop, that there's half of us split up.
And you lost some men to Octus as well, didn't you?
Yes, that was happening at the same time, more or less. Frank Johnson came to my tail a lot, because Frank was a sergeant, there was about 6, 8 sergeants on that camp at the time. Now, Frank, he had been a sergeant for a while, and he went off to Octu to train in the Port Commission. There was another one at the same time from one of the other troops, George Duke. But Frank, in particular, he was well known amongst us. He was a big miss out of the sergeant's mess. But, of course, by that time, I wasn't in the sergeant's mess, but I knew Frank very well. He was one of them. He was the AC-IG. He was the command post. He was the command post sergeant anyway. He was more or less the top sergeant of them, you know, and had a really place. There was an officer in charge of the command post, and then the sergeant as his assistant, and Frank was the assistant sergeant, and he knew his plumbing, and he knew his instruments and such. They went off to Octu, and like I say, there was others went. But only two that I can remember, Frank and George Duke from the other two.
He was to end up in the 1st Battalion, DLI, wasn't he? George Duke was to end up in the 1st Battalion, DLI.
He finished in the 1st Battalion, Derby. Frank, give me a bit of his history now.
Well, we'll come back to him, because you re-meet him in the 16th Battalion,
that's
don't you?
Right.
Mm. Right. So, anything else about your time at Port Suez?
Not a great deal. We carried on pretty much as we were along with the blacks. It was pretty quiet.
And then the next thing was a move to Benghazi, which you thought was round about the back end of 1943, November, December.
I think it would be about then. Of course, by that time, that was after Alamein, and it was obvious that Kerry wasn't coming back through the desert again. The First Army had landed on the other side, and although it wasn't obvious to us, must have been obvious to the powers that be that the North African campaign was more or less over. So we then were transferred straight away up. We left our guns, yes, we left our guns in service, and we went as a battery up to Benghazi, travelled by train, and quite a good route that we stopped off at Tobruk. We'd be about 5 days on the road through there, travelling on the train. I spent most of my time on the luggage rack. Being a little rock, it was the easiest way out the road, you know. And we stopped off to Tobruk for a couple of days. And there's a thing, of course it was all quiet at Tobruk then, all the trouble was gone and such like, but there was no water. And that's what amazes me with nowadays. The thing about the water here now, we're an island surrounded by water. Now, Tobruk, and that's in the 40s, we were drinking seawater, but it was distilled. And it was pretty hot, but at least it kept me alive. It's true, so it makes you wonder, you know, there should be progress as far as the water goes nowadays. We were allowed one bottle of fresh water, and any other water we used was, I don't know how they treated it, but you could tell it was sea water, the taste wasn't all gone. It was horrible stuff, but it was water. It's going to make a difference with people right now. In what's this, 92? In 3 or 4 years' time, when they've got to conserve water the way we had to conserve it in the desert, they can keep the price down by then.
Now, you went up to Benghazi then, and what did you take over guns there?
Yes. Now, we were right on the seafront too. We could see Benghazi, the buildings and such, but we weren't. Half a mile, you might say, over the port. Trying to think what country I'm in. Yeah, they were mobile guns, built in pretty much the same way, a very static site. But they were mobile guns dug into gun pits. And we were stuck around there. And it was just before that when I had got made up to sergeant. Actually, just before we left Sioux, I got made up land sergeant. So when I got up into Benghazi, of course, I shared the sergeant's mess.
Now, what was the sergeant's mess like? What did that offer you? What did the sergeant's mess offer? You know, what could you do?
As apart from a rank, well, it was a different status straight away. I could mix to the same extent, but not quite with my mates. You know what I mean? You were a sergeant, you had to act as a sergeant. But I was only land sergeant in any case. Full sergeant got a gun to wear, and probably 3 stripes. I never got that far with the artillery. And the sergeant's mess, we ate on our own. We had our own quarters. We had our own sergeant's mess where we got a spirit ration. The boys never got a spirit ration. Now, it was a good thing in a way for me, because it cured me of drinking spirits. I'm not a spirit drinker nowadays.
How did it cure you?
Well, you used to get a monthly spirit ration. Now, once we settled down in Benghazi, the routine was pretty much the same as we had at Sioux, because things were quiet. The war had moved away from us again. We went in and had a look around the Benghazi itself, and there was nothing there. It wasn't as good as going to Sioux or Port Said or anywhere, where I had spent odd days on leave. But Benghazi was just a bloody mess, you know. But the spirit ration, you used to get it once a month. I just forget how much it was now. But there was 7 or 8 of us, and we used to get 7 or 8. Lots of spirit bottles stuff. But of course, we had the beer supply as well. It's come pretty regular. But it was warm beer. I shouldn't say warm, should I? Western Oriental gentleman. It was Egyptian beer. Or Arab beer, anyway. Stella. Stella beer. Or Gao.
What was that like?
D-O-A-W. Dow, you know the ship. Dow, yeah. It was reasonable, not what you were used to, but it was all you could get. You were thankful for it. With the spirits, yeah. I was never a spirit drinker at the best of times, but of course, when you got the month's spirit passion up, which usually it was a party night, stuff around Sunday, get round and ship the spirit night. No good giving it for a month and doling it out in little bits, you know. We used to have a night and clear it out. And with this particular, I think, was only about the third time we got a rum ration, a spirit ration. And they sent some rum up. And it wasn't R-U-M, rum. It was R-U-H-M, rum, Egyptian stuff. But it was spirits. And of course, there was other stuff as well. They had the whiskey and the gin. The gin wasn't too bad, you know. I never drank a lot of it, but it was a cool drink. But the rum, dear mate, Anyway, we got this particular one washing, and we sat and drunk it all night. And there was only two of us left at the finish, I can remember. Forget what the caller there, he was another Yorkshire man, big moustache and specs. His name would come to me. But there was only two of us left, the rest were under the table or lying, you know, on a bed or something. About 5 o'clock in the morning. And I staggered off to my own bunk. But when it came to revaluing, I had to turn out, but to get them the guns and do the maintenance. And I was in there shopping and fishing. And anyway, he got me up. Well, it was the one particular about dress then, you know, a pair of shorts and your boots and socks and your little hat. So it wasn't the dress in effect, but once I got under the guns, I forget who I had as a Lance Bombardier then, second in command, I says, I'm off to the toilet, see the things. Now the toilets, they were just a great big hole in the ground, dug, and there was a half a dozen frames, you know, wood with a hole cut in where you could sit in a row and chat, and a bit hessian round about on stakes, opposite toilets. No roof. And of course, by the time I got across there, it was getting 9 in the morning, and the sun was reaching down, and I got in there and I sat. It came from both ends, spewed. And it was green. I'm telling you, it was really green. And I felt terrible. It did. But anyway, it came to 10 o'clock. You could get your half-hour break. Usually that was by then into the sarms mess and a cup of tea, rolled up. But they realised I was never out there and they said, get off to bed. And I was in bed 2.5 days. At least, I couldn't shift off that bed, and it cured me. The spirit rushing after that was there, so I didn't want any, I'd stick with the beer. And I've done, even now, very rarely with spirits. So it saved me a lot of time, although I suffered.
So the routine was pretty much the same. Was there anything happened in particular, any air raids or anything at Benghazi?
Not a lot. We had no trouble whatsoever. We did a little bit fishing because so far along the beach from where we were, there'd been an anti-ammunition depot or something. And there's a lot of stuff left lying around. And we weren't supposed to, but we used to go scrounge in there and we used to pick a few of these red devils up. They were high-tie hand grenades, the red plastic job. So you could take these and you could go, spring them, swing them in the sea, and boom, and the fish used to come floating up. That was the best fishing we ever did. You didn't get many big ones. What there was, you had a few fish, but it was made it a bit tester. But as far as action went, I don't think we never had any at all at Benghazi.
You weren't there that long, were you?
Not a long time. It's hard to remember now, just tell you how long, but it wasn't a long time, maybe 3 months, might have been about 3 months, I guess, and then we got the order to move, and that was a big move, quite a move, because we had to take our guns with us then, we were provided with matadors, and we had to take the guns, and with being we'd done very little mobile work, so we had very few experienced divers, and we had no donars. That's run about back and forth with the convoy. We had a lad called Superbody, Lancashire lad. Superbody had been one of my gun crew for a bit. But anyway, they decided that Sup, as we called him, he was going to be our donar. He'd never been on a bike in his life. He had one of these beavers, the regular VSA job with the guys he used, gave them the gear, put them on and let them run around the camp a couple of times, two or three times. He maybe had half a day one day and then the following day another half a day. And he could make them, he could run around with a motorbike, which most could, you know, with a few hours time, and there was nothing to eat around the desert. And so some of them became a Damar. And we left Benghazi, and we travelled from Benghazi in convoy with the Matadors and the .7 guns behind, and all the various paraphernalia, the 3-ton lorries with the coop stores and things like that. Was quite a convoy. I have some photos somewhere with it. And we went as far as we could, and round about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, we probably stopped and have a meal and get down with the bed over alongside the truck or the gun or whatever. But you wanted your greatcoat on because it always got pretty cold during the night. It was hot during the day, but hellish cold during the night. Of course, the mud was thin with the wind and the sun. We traveled right down there, right down the Suez. We crossed the Suez Canal. I think it was somewhere halfway up the canal. What was it now? I can remember cutting those guns onto a ferry across the Suez because we only had an inch to spare with the matadors on either side of the ferry. Anyway, they took us across the Suez, across the canal, and we went from there up through the Sinai Desert, right up through Palestine, as it was then, not Israel, into Syria. We went the other side of Damascus. I don't know what they call the place, but it was a few kilometres out of Damascus, and it had something to do with that time with Turkey, the Turkish border with Syria, whether they were going into Turkey or whether Jerry was coming up through Turkey to us, I don't know, but that was the reason we went there, I think. But we never went into action there, but it was a hell of a trip. We must have been on the road, fortnight or 3 weeks, and that was an experience in itself, especially with Shrop, as this day came up, because when we first started out, of course, Shrop was riding up and down with his motorbike all the way. It came the night time, we had to lift Shufflebottom up his bike. His hands were stuck to the handle bars, his legs wouldn't work. And we used to lift him off his bike and sit him down and feed him. And eventually he'd straighten out. And then next morning we'd be off again. He'd do it all day. We had to lift him off again. I think he was only just getting real experience by the time we got up into Syria. But it must be now. Kind of an experience for him. He'd never been on a motorbike in his life before, you know. But it was funny to us to see him. He couldn't open his hands and couldn't move his legs. It was experiences like that that made you realize, just put it pretty clear, because we had never been really mobile, as you might say, and that was a long pull. I remember when we got to the other side of the Sinai Desert, it's when we first came on to, what would they call them now, orange groves? It was where the cultivation was, and there was oranges, lemons, limes, on these trees, you know. And the first one we pulled up on the side, was on the convoy stop. We used to stop around dinner time, you know, when I got grew up. We stopped there, and before we left, the Matador truck was knee deep in oranges and grapefruits, lemons, and the thing is, you could eat them straight from the tree. They were so different at this country. A grapefruit, you know what it's like, you eat a grapefruit here, you've probably got to cover it with sugar to keep a bit of taste. Take one off the tree and eat it, and just like a real Jaffa orange. Lovely. Same with the lemons. You could eat the lemon, as long as you give it off the tree, you eat it. you really lovely. We had nothing like that. Like I say, before we pulled away from that, where that cultivation was, we were knee deep in Jefferson, God knows what in the bottom of that, so the last bit for long enough. But I never forget that. That I've always known what we get in this country is so different to what we get on the spot.
Now, what about the site, just the other side of Damascus? Well,
there was nothing there. Like, we didn't go onto a gun site or anything. We went on our camp, and it was a holding camp. As you know, they were missing puts, those corrugated sheet things. And we stuck our guns in a row, covered them up with gun tarpaulins, and they stood there all the time we were in that camp.
So you didn't dig them in?
No, we just lined them up. We were supposed to be ready to pull out to wherever we were sent to go and die, but which never happened. we have practically no routine at all. There is the little big drill or lectures. Put anyone out they could to give a talk on something or other, just to keep the boys occupied. But we were there quite a while. We spent Christmas there. Which Christmas would that be? It'd be 43, I think, wouldn't it? But anyway, we spent Christmas there. And it snowed. Now, we'd come up in the desert. We were pretty red hot. We got up there. And we got this snow, well, and such a change, especially for the blacks. Now, the blacks were there, they had every bit, every item of clothing that they had issued, they had on. And they had to put themselves away at the top of the camp. And me and Bill Carling, who was Sergeant Major, we had to take them on one ration up. But of course, they didn't drink. They were religious and they didn't drink. But we still took them on one ration up. I think there was a couple of them tried their own, because it was such a state these days. They were stuck there. You couldn't get them moving. They'd never seen snow before. So me and Ben took the room rushing up. I had only one, but Bill had quite a few rooms. And what was left of the room rushing in the bottle, he took back to the sergeant's mess, and they enjoyed it. Like I say, I'd cured myself of really swimming cleaning. Pity at that stage, but there it was. That was, around Christmas time, just over Damascus. Now, like I say, we celebrated Christmas there. Little Georgie Woodhead from Leeds. How we got hold of this stuff, I don't know, but it could be got to Alec. Alec, or maybe something like, what would you call it? But the fancy drink that he can get out of France now, only worse.
Pernod.
Something of the similar lines. But Christmas time, of course, was a booze up for most of them. Wasn't for me, mine was new yet. But the. I know little Georgie Woodhead, he got drunk on this cereal. And the next morning, he had a glass of water. And it was worse than it was the night before, and they were in that sort of thing. But they had a right time, and I can remember the Christmas dinner. We had to serve the dinner, officers and sergeants served the dinner to the lads, which was the tradition. I remember that Christmas, definitely. And there was another thing we did while we were there. We had it was the battery commander. He was getting promoted to major. And we had a farewell dinner for him in Damascus itself. Gibson. Where he went, I don't know, but anyway, was one of the sergeants who was good at that sort of thing. He organized a dinner for all the sergeants and officers to have dinner. a farewell dinner for the battery commander moving on. And that was in Damascus itself, and it was west of Kinnan. And the wounds were out there, and they paid a pretty great plates with all sorts of different things on, you know. And it was quite an occasion, of course, you had to get toughed up, and, you know, have your hair combed and that. And one of the few things that in the army, I never came across it until I went to the infantry, where they were mainly regular soldier routine. All this stuff there, I had been with the artillery, they were territorial minded soldiers, you know. But that was an example of regular soldiers, you might say.
Now, how long were you there? You must have got there about in December.
Must have been somewhere around that time, yeah. And now from there, I don't remember a deal how long we were there. But it seemed a long time because the weather was bad. I did a trip across into where the trouble is now, where the Israelites are having trouble. And Beirut, isn't it? Beirut.
What, on your own? No.
No, it was the opportunity to have a long day in Beirut. We had a ride across there. Somebody had some business there, and it took, no one had any particular duties, so we took a ride out to Beirut. But it was no different than going to any of the other places. But there was trouble. And it seems strange. We didn't bother them, but we found out like the bottle for the men, the bottle for the sergeants, and the bottle for the officers. You know, it was amusing. It was more than anything else. And in any case, this officers did no good. It was because we couldn't perform. It's something that never occurred to me, really. I said, yeah, he had a lot of talk from the lad, but I think it was mainly talk as much as anything.
So this was another quiet period, basically.
Yeah.
And what was your next move?
That's where I'm trying to weigh up where we went from. Best I can remember. I can't even remember losing the guns. What happened to them? We went back down to the sewers area. We were Port Said. Oh, yeah. We went to Port Said. We came up here to Port Said and we were on the gun site there for a while. But there was nothing happening there. The war more or less was over. That was practically on the side of the canal. And we were there a couple of months or so, and I think it was from there that we started demobbing us, more or less. They're going to get rid of the unit.
Not demobbing, but disbanding.
Disbanding. Mm. And to the best of my recollections, I think it must have been from Port Said where we started disbanding.
How did you feel about that? I mean, you'd had quite an easy war, which is a good thing, really, for
well, I don't know. I think I was looking forward to it, because at various times, I'd always put in for to get a transfer.
To what?
To something more active. You know, but it seemed difficult, because they wouldn't let NCOs go, and you just never got the chance.
What were you trying to get to the infantry, or do you mean to an artillery unit in action?
Anything would have done, I think. It wasn't my idea. I remember when we were in Benghazi, I had a lad with me, came from Leeds, and he was a bit of an artist. And around the gun site itself, we had these big barrels. They were the 40-gallon drums then. They were built in to where we made our gun sight walls. Well, the bottom of the barrel was facing Inhover. And he used to paint on these things. And he had Mickey Mouse and Popeye and Dollar Oil on each of the things. And I had one, and I had written on there in paint, like, "They also serve who only stand and wait." That was my attitude at the time, you know. Said, we never done no bloody fighting. What were soldiers for? You know. It was mainly, I think it would be a bit different now, right? But as a young lad, I wanted to have a go. You know? So it didn't really bother me to think that they were going to split that unit up and we'd get somewhere else.
Do you know the month they split you up? It'd be in 1944, wouldn't it?
It was in early 44, I would think, I'd guess, yeah. And, they couldn't tell you the month. It was so long ago.